Okay, so, guess I will start by going over the quiz, since we have a bunch of questions about that, and then we'll talk about more generally things we covered last time. So the quiz has a bunch of stuff on two-phase commit. So question on 2A, since A is going to redo the last operation, wouldn't that make this occur? So there's two reasons why that doesn't help. So one reason is that A always has the option of deciding it's going to abort the transaction. So a valid thing to do is say, we need to redo preparing. I'm going to redo it by assuming that, you know, someone failed and I'm going to decide to abort because I can unilaterally do that if I didn't get a reply back. Another thing is that it might be the case that when A tries to do the transaction again, that it can't contact B or C and the transaction will end up being aborted as a result. A question on 4, can I go over why C isn't true? So note that we're talking about changing the permissions on the executable itself. And the user could already run the executable because they started this at user ID program. And we don't want to let them do other things like writing to the executable. So this is not going to be applicable. We might want to, as we'll discuss later today, have the executable change who it's running as for other reasons. But that's not going to change the permissions on the executable file. That's going to be a change to the process that the executable spawned. Other questions on the quiz? So a question for question 3, doesn't the kernel need to access the file that contains the user password mapping? Yes, I don't consider that part of running the check, but I see the argument there because, the kernel is just implementing a read file operation. It's not implementing a read password file operation. That's special. But I see the confusion there. I guess I'll have to think about whether I want to change the key a bit. Or probably at least give partial credit to something. Other questions? Partial credit for E. Other quiz questions? Okay, so not seeing any. I'm not sure I might. Okay. So last time we started talking about sort of security enforced in the OS. And we separated the notion of sort of security where we have some policy that keeps us safe from protection, which are these mechanisms for enforcing users access things they should not, and this is based on, some specification. So these protection mechanisms, don't tell us what the right policy is, They just enforce some policy. And usually the idea is that we're going to, supply these protection mechanisms to our system administrator, And they are going to use that to enforce some real security policy. So an example was sort of page tables are a protection mechanism. They're a way of keeping users from accessing things we don't want them to, but to actually make that have any security guarantees, we need to set up what things we allow users to access. And this means we talked about, you know, our main problem, which was how do we specify what users can access? And we had this abstraction of an access control matrix that we divided our processes into these protection domains. And we had these objects. And for each combination of an object and a protection domain, we had the operations you would be allowed to do. And conceptually, we could store this entire table, but sort of it's kind of this big sparse table. And in practice, we kind of store the same information, but in a different way, most commonly using this idea of an access control list, that with every object, like a file or a process, we store a list of the protection domains, which we usually think of as things like users or groups, and what they're allowed to do, what they have permission to do. So for example, for files, this might be read, write, execute. For like a process, this might be terminating the process or debugging it. We have this list of what operations you're allowed to do based on protection domains. And we saw sort of concrete examples of what this list looked like for files. We saw that sort of in its base form, the POSIX standard specified this extremely limited access control list where you could specify one user, one group, and everyone else, and whether they could read, write, or execute each file. And we also had these sort of less widely supported, more flexible ideas where rather than just having one user and one group, we can specify as many as we like. And with either of these ideas, these would be stored alongside the file, so we need some support from our file system, like typically in a POSIX system, there will be extra fields in the inode to support this. If we have this access control list, like how is that used? And we learned that the mechanism to implement it is that, well, you can't access a file without a system call, and the system call entry is going to check, well, are you someone who's allowed to access it according to this access control list I'm reading? And notice that we couldn't trust user mode code to do this because, you know, even if, say, the system call wrapper for open that we supplied, you know, checked whether you were allowed to access the file, that doesn't mean that someone can't write their own system call wrapper included in their application. But they can't write their own code that's going to run in kernel mode, which is why we did it within the system call handler itself. Then we talked about, well, you know, if we're enforcing these protections, we need to have some notion of sort of what users and groups of processes in. And we learned in POSIX what we do is we'd add these user and group ID fields to the process control block. And POSIX made this choice, sort of this Unix choice, is that the kernel knows IDs only. These only, not names. And all the stuff that dealt with names and figuring out, you know, what those IDs meant was handled outside of the kernel, typically by things running with the special user ID 0 that, you know, we had this convention that when we did these access control tricks, user ID 0 would be treated specially and said, we'd say, just say yes. We talked about, well, you know, let's say I want to allow users to do things where sort of our usual policy is that we don't just allow users to do it. So one example is mounting file systems. I don't want you to be able to manipulate what file systems are active such that, you know, make it so no one can access the current disk, but I do want maybe typical users to be able to plug in a USB key and read its files. So I want to give restricted access to this file system setup capability. But usually the way the system call for that works on Unix is that it just checks, are you a user authorized to do anything with file systems or not? It doesn't have that more fine-grained idea of you can use USB sticks, but you can't reconfigure, you know, the main hard drive. So a solution to this is that we can have programs which run with extra privileges. And the mechanism POSIX provides for this is something known as set user ID programs, that we set a flag on the executable file. So this is something that's stored in the file system. that tells exec to change to a different user ID, to set the user ID to a new value when running that program. And this allows our system administrator to set up a program I can run, which is mount a USB stick, you know, which will run as that privileged user, typically the super user, root user ID 0, and do that mount operation. But because it's going to be programmed in a way where it's not going to let me just do anything, you know, it's not the same as like giving me sort of full access to the system, like giving me a shell prompt that runs as root would. So questions about these things we covered last time? So the question is, what prevents someone from creating a program that does something malicious with a set user ID flag? So it runs as the owner user ID. So, you know, that means that if you have user ID 500, you can create a set user ID program often, but typically it will run as your user ID. So it won't, you won't be able to make, do anything that you couldn't already do anyways. So to set it up as the sort of super user, someone needs to be running as user ID 0 when they set up the set UID program. Does that answer that question or follow-ups? Okay. So a question, are forks and set user ID programs also set user ID? So when you fork in a set use in a program process in general, it copies the user ID just like it copies the other stuff in the process control block. So a set user ID program that forks is going to still have that parent process running as the new user ID and the child process. Other questions? Okay, so a logistic note about our upcoming exam. As noted on the schedule, it opens 1 p.m. 8 May. I've hopefully copied this correctly from the schedule and not incorrectly. So 1 p.m. 8 May and just do 1 p.m. 9 May. It's going to be via the quiz system. I will announce sort of the details of that later. The likely instructions to give you an idea what policies are is going to be that it's going to be open book and open notes, but you only use resources that were created before this exam was released. So for example, if someone or you asked a question on Stack Overflow, which is exactly the question on the exam, after the exam was released, well, that was created after the exam was released and you should not use it. And of course, you may not collaborate with other students. We ask that you show your work in the comment field so we can give partial credit. If you don't do that, well, you're not going to get much partial credit. And we will actually check those for partial credit, you know, even for things like multiple choice questions. And generally, I'm going to try to have some proofreading happen of the exam, but if you think a question's ambiguous or unclear, we're unlikely to be able to provide clarification, partly because I anticipate some people will like do the exam from like 1 to 4 p.m. or 1 to 5, you know, on 8 May. And it wouldn't be very nice to tell them later that, oh, you have to change your interpretation of that. So we're probably going to try to sort of deal with it after the fact, possibly like accepting more answers than we intended if we think the question really is ambiguous. So questions about exam logistics. Oh, and the big thing is next lecture is a review session. So I have some slides today on things like virtual machines. We probably won't get to all of them. And if we don't cover all of them, we're not going to cover that stuff this semester. So next section is going to be a review session that will cover things that you ask me about. If you don't ask me about something, I am not going to talk about them. I'm just going to assume that you're comfortable enough with that topic. And question on logistics. So other online resources are fair game, assuming they're maybe prior to the exam date? Yes. Do I have general expectation of the amount of time it should take? My goal is to have an exam where if we were giving it written in person, it would be reasonable to give in the scheduled 3-hour exam slot. That doesn't mean that I know students will end up taking that amount of time, partly because I know that if I had gave the same exam I usually gave in a 12-hour exam slot, students would take 12 hours. And partly because it's a little tricky to calibrate the amount of time spent on an open book exam. But that's what I'm aiming for. So that would be comfortable to finish in 3 hours. Other questions, follow-ups? Okay. So let's go to sort of some little missing topics in talking about security. So on the quiz, the last question asked about having this hypothetical program which will let you print to a printer and enforce a page limit. And, to do that, we might have a program where it set user ID, and, our program might be sort of, print file and, some file name. And the question is, can we just call open? And we have to be a little more careful than that because, you don't want me to be able to do on a multi-user system, print file like, say, Etsy Shadow, where Etsy Shadow, this is where the password information is stored. That would be bad. Because printing them out obviously will give me access to that information. So we don't want to allow that. So we don't want to just blindly open, because that's going to give whoever's running our print file program access to things that they're not supposed to have access to. And you might say, okay, well, I can't just open any file. So let's do something where I check what file the user is trying to access and see if it's okay. And if so, I open it and print it. And, you might think this should prevent you from opening a file you're not supposed to read, like the file that contains password information on the system, even if the print file program could read it. We're going to need some way to figure out the original user, but it turns out that information is kept in a set user ID program. It's available via a system call. But there's a problem with this approach, which is that there's a race condition. And this pattern comes up a lot, where people try to write code like this and it's broken because of a race condition. And unlike sort of our normal race conditions, these aren't going to just be, that's a nice little, bug that happens occasionally. This is going to be a big security problem, because a user is going to be able to use this to kind of completely defeat this check. And why doesn't it not work? Well, what a malicious user does is they create a file to print. We check whether it's printable. And in between when we make the check and when we open it, the user replaces that file with a link to another file. So you might say, what's this link system call? So link, creates a okay, apparently don't have my tablet work. So this is a directory entry with, you know, same inode number. So this makes secret and toprint be the same file. If that wasn't possible, you can use a symbolic link, or you can potentially, in some circumstances, rename something. Or another way this could happen is that if you have a program that's creating a file that you're not supposed to read, you can create a file in the same place and then delete that file and run that program in the middle here. So, like, for example, if the password-changing program created a temporary file, you know, like that, you could, you know, try to make the password-changing program run in this time span here. So this issue in general where, you know, we, you know, our set user ID program makes a check, you know, and then does something based on that check, but sort of the validity of that check changes in between because the file changes, you know. So in this case, you know, our primary example, the file, instead of being an innocent to text file, becomes a secret file that the user doesn't have permission to read. This is known as a time to check to time of use vulnerability, sometimes abbreviated time to check to time of use, TOCTTOU vulnerability. And this is a really common issue if you're thinking about coding something like a set user ID program, where you're going to want to access something based on your command line. You kind of want to think about this issue. So a question about this link command, is the link adding toprint to the secret directory? No. So this is saying that that let's say we're running in, you know, /foo, you know, this is saying that foo toprint.txt, if this was our current directory here, would be the same file as /secret. That's what that call would do. The way this would work is that, you know, we, like previously toprint.txt had pointed to like inode 100. This would make it point to the same inode number that /secret had before the link call. So what's sort of a clean way of dealing with this? And the sort of cleanest way of doing this is that there's a mechanism for set user ID programs to temporarily become the original user. So when we looked at how you get the current user ID, you may have noticed that the call was get EUID for effective user ID. You may have wondered, well, what's the effective for? And this is what it's for. It's that in a set user ID program, there's, you know, at least there's another user ID, sometime, you know, actually multiple other user IDs, but sort of the, you know, one that's pretty canonical is there's a real user ID. That's the original user ID, and you can swap between the two. So you can temporarily switch back to the quote unquote real user ID. You know, this is whoever ran the set UID program. Do the open, and the open will run without any special permissions, and then switch back. And now there's no difference between the time of check to time of use because the open is doing the checking. And the open is going to use whatever file it was you're actually opening, not some file which might change between when you check and when you open. So questions about this sort of swapping back to the old permissions idea? Question, so what is becoming the original user? The set user ID program. So basically changing the user ID used for permissions checks. So the question is, why bother with set user ID? So in the case of our print program, you know, and here it's going to be an access the printer that the user can't access themselves. So the question is, and it does this because it wouldn't have permission to use link unlink? No, that's not the difference. So the difference here is that if we think of the timeline, set user ID program and, you know, other program, that we're going to change to original user, open, and check permissions, and change back. And this open and check, this is one atomic operation. So there's nowhere in here, sort of, you know. So we can't change truePrint.text before the open and check because the check will fail. And we can't change after because the check already happened. Check and open already happened. And what we're depending on is that the open operation that the kernel implements doesn't have the same sort of problem. Does that answer the question of sort of how this deals with preventing the link unlink from being useful? So question is, why was open not atomic before? So it was, but the problem was that the open operation wasn't how we were checking whether the original user could access the files. That because we were running as a different user, we originally decided in this sort of naive solution to do the check separately from the open. Then another question, if the change is temporary, when do you revert this? So the usual sort of programming strategy is that you change back to the original user just for the things the original user, you're doing on the original user's behalf that you want their permissions for. Then you go back to, you know, your special user for things like accessing the printer. Other questions on this idea? The question is the permissions allowed if statement gone now? Yes. So in this solution, we eliminate the permissions allowed sort of check. It happens because the open is being done, not because we have some extra check. Okay, so you might say that this race condition here, like, this seems like a big problem that we can, like, make this program access open files we're not supposed to. But it seems like we needed to get awfully lucky, like, to make sure that, you know, we squeezed in this code that did a bunch of system calls to manipulate the file that it was trying to access, you know, basically in this small time window here. Like, this should be very fast. And, you know, a lot of people thought for a while that these weren't very, you know, these were bad, something you wanted to fix, but it wasn't maybe so dangerous. But there are ways of making this a lot more practical. And so one issue is that POSIX systems support typically symbolic links. So a symbolic link is basically a file that's an alias for another file where it contains the path of the other file. So this is really handy if, like, you have a web server and you, like, want to expose to the web server directory that's elsewhere on the server. Like, you can make a symbolic link. The web server will try to access, you know, foo/bar, and foo can be stored in a completely different location rather than you having to copy the foo files over to the web server's main directory. This is a nice feature, but some people observe that, you know, if you want to make this sort of time window larger, you can use symbolic links to make the operating system's open call spend a whole lot of time figuring out where a file is. And that gives you more time to change where the file is at the end of this whole process. And often there are tricks like this with these sorts of vulnerabilities in general, where you have some sort of permissions check followed by accessing the thing that permissions check uses. This is a common pattern of sort of broken things in operating system-like code, you know, or code that tries to use operating system sort of access control APIs. And often there's some trick like this where, you know, you think it's a very tiny time window to change what that thing is, but it's really not, because the attacker can manipulate this, you know, make things slow to make that a bigger issue. So there are ways of, So there are ways of handling these permission checks if you can't temporarily change the user. So which of these ideas might work? So if you aren't able to change the user, you know, there are some solutions that still work. But I think the idea of changing the user sort of is generally a lot sort of cleaner. So we have mixes. So go with the most popular. So B is a correct solution. And it's in fact the only correct solution here. So why does B work? And the big thing is that once the file is opened, it's always the same file. And because fstat uses the file descriptor, it's always the file we opened. So B is an alternate solution where we're dealing with the problem because even though we're checking what the permissions not at the same time we're opening the file, we're checking the permissions on the same thing, and we're very sure it's the same thing because open doesn't change what file you have opened after you open, right? Once you open a file, it doesn't magically change to another file. So B is okay. So the next most popular answer is A. And A does make the work harder for someone trying to, you know, take advantage of this problem. But the issue is that in A, we're going to have sort of a check here. And we can do sort of this process in reverse in between the open and the second check. So it makes it harder, but it doesn't actually solve the problem. So it makes it harder to exploit. You know, by doing sort of this switch what the file refers to twice, we can still make it so you open the wrong file. And for C, this just doesn't solve the problem because of things like symbolic links and links, the user can have a directory which has a file that's sensitive. And even if we didn't have something like links or symbolic links, the user could create a directory that contains a normal file that they control and then delete that directory in between the time when we check the permissions and when we open it and have something else create a directory in the place that they're not supposed to be able to read. Questions on these answers? These examples. I don't know if I will. Let's do sort of think about sort of what mechanisms we have. So let's say I want to have students collaborate in small groups on a shared server. So what sort of mechanisms have we talked about which would be useful for this? And what sort of things do we want to allow that sort of may not be naturally allowed? So I'll take answers in chat for so thinking of things we want to allow, so we want to allow students in a group to share files. This has something to share files. We want to prevent students from accessing files not from their group. Okay. And so some idea for this is that, group IDs seem useful. So if we assign every group a POSIX group ID, then they can set the ACL on their files to allow their group to read write them. But without allowing everyone. So this is sort of like the natural scenario where sort of that group ID idea seems to make a lot of sense. If we didn't have group IDs, we could just set an ACL where we manually listed every student in the group. Sort of the alternative is ACLs listing every student in a group. But another scenario, let's say I want to let students submit assignment files to faculty on a shared server. And so what do I want to allow and prevent? So I want to allow what things do I want to allow here? So someone's jumping right to a mechanism. So can you tell me, someone's jumping right to a mechanism for two here. So going back to one, someone proposed a set user ID program that lets users edit files of other students in their group. So this seems That seems like an idea that would like allow this collaboration. I would be concerned that we want to maybe be a little careful about that because we want to like kind of distinguish between all the users' files and the files they want to use for their collaboration. That is another thing we could do. How about on this second scenario, how could we use a POSIX mechanism to let students submit files on a shared server? So like you can all log into Portal. Let's say you wanted to have like you be able to submit from the Portal command line, not using like a website. So what do we want to allow here and prevent? I think prevent is probably the key thing to think of. So prevent sort of prevent huge submissions, prevent reading other students' submissions. Okay. Anything else we want to prevent? And prevent updating other submissions. Other submissions. We probably, surprise not mentioned, we probably want to prevent updating own old submissions after they're due. Okay. So, but allow creating a file, a submission file, and writing to it. So how could we use mechanisms to do this? So for creating files only, we can have a directory with an access control list only allowing writes. So that's sort of part of the solution here. Writes. For, you know, preventing updates after the deadline, this seems tricky. So one solution is that we, you know, copy the file. Writes. And another solution is that, you know, maybe we adjust the access control list after the deadline. But this seems both cases kind of like something else needs to happen. As for creating files only, so if the directory only allows writes, that might allow file deletions. So it seems like we need more flexible. CL, you know, writes. You know, so because the problem is that writes, but this would allow deletion, so that's, you know. So we need something a little more restrictive. So it seems like we need a more flexible ACL, or sort of the alternative, and what I've seen people try to do here is because the ACL is not flexible enough, because we can't really specify write to create a file, but not for any other reason. You know, often the solution we'll learn at work on is a set user ID program. Really? Another point is someone said, oh, you might want to limit the number of submissions. Yeah. And that's also something we can't really do with access control lists because they're not likely to have that knob. So this is a case where probably I think we'd arrive at some sort of set user ID program based approach if we wanted to like have it be a command line tool, just because we can't really enforce the rules we want with this sort of read write permissions that POSIX like ACLs will give us. But we can get kind of close by just having a write-only directory. And perhaps like one per student or something like that. Okay. So that's where I'm going to leave off on security. Oh, no, sorry. One more topic on security. And then we'll have our sort of extremely brief foray into virtual machines, I guess. So I'd like to talk about a very different way of organizing how permissions work in OSs. So in the POSIX design, sort of, we have this information that's kind of on the side, that processes have these user and group IDs that let you know what happens. It's on the side because, like, when I make an open call, like, I don't actually explicitly specify what permissions I have. That's kind of figured out based on what process I'm running in. This is sometimes called ambient authority. And there's an alternate design that many sort of very non-POSIX-like OSs have tried to tend towards, where the ability to access a file is permission to access. Ability to access a resource is permission to access. And this is based on an idea known as capabilities, where a token that identifies something is the permission to access it. And this means that we'll have this sort of opaque token for accessing any resource on the system. And that means rather than having a separate check for can you access this, it's going to be part of the what is this thing you're trying to access. So in some senses, this is simpler. It's certainly, you know, simpler to implement the permissions check in the OS because it's kind of free, right? That when we're looking up what the thing the program is trying to access, we're going to check it that it has the permission to access it. And to give a concrete example to hopefully make this clear, there's a couple things that we've seen that are capabilities. And one example is file descriptors. File descriptors are a list of open files the process has access to. And the file descriptor itself is the token to access something on that list. And when a process does a read or a write, we just look up what the file is. We don't need to do a permissions check because we know the permissions check happened when we created that access token. So when we created the capability, the thing that lets us access the file descriptor, you know, we did the permissions check then. If a process has a file descriptor, we know it's okay to access. And we can think of sort of a page table in kind of the same way. A page table gives us a list of physical pages the program can access. If something's in your page table as valid, you can access it because we already made the check when we put it in there. And, you know, this idea of capability, so it kind of works very nicely for open files and for physical pages, but we can kind of extend this to more resources and, more importantly, make these be something that's sort of easier for programs to pass around. Because a lot of what we're doing with, like, file names and access control list there is that we need to pass a file around, so we pass it around by its file name. But what we'd like to instead do is, say, pass it around via its file descriptor. And that's fine to do within a program, but, like, I couldn't call my, you know, print file program with an already open file. We just didn't really have a mechanism to do that. Well, if you think about it, well, we actually did. Like, we could open it before we exec, but, you know, that's not something that, you know, applies in many situations. So if we think of the file descriptors, well, you know, we can inherit them by spawn programs, but really, we want some way of, like, passing these sort of tokens to access a resource, you know, to arbitrary local programs. And in fact, Unix supports this for file descriptors. It's not part of POSIX, but pretty much every Unix system has some flavor of being able to send a file descriptor, an open file, from one program to another, even if they're not related, over a local socket. And so sort of what's nice about this from a security perspective is that if you think of, like, using this mechanism to tell another program what file to access, well, you know, there's no way we can kind of mess up the permissions check on whether I'm really allowed, know, as the someone person specifying that file, really allowed to access that file. Because I opened it, I'm passing a token that allows access to it. We don't need to worry about that time to check to time of use thing. We don't need to worry about who are we checking the access control list while being the right user ID. You know, that's kind of going to be done implicitly. And as an example of what this might look like if we apply this to more resources than just file descriptors, talk about sort of a design from a research project a bit back, which sort of did a notional API for what this would look like in a Unix-like system. And they extended FreeBSD because it was something that was easier for them to program. And they had this sort of opt-in system where programs could, rather than accessing things via something where you'd have an access control list on the side, we'd access via these capabilities, you know, and that would be how we do the permissions check. That if you had the capability, that meant you could access it. If you didn't get the cast the capability, that meant you weren't allowed to access it. And they implemented these as file descriptors. So rather than, in this system, rather than naming a directory and reading, you know, reading its files, you get a file descriptor for the directory. If you had it, that file descriptor would let you access the directory. And the directory file descriptor would have permissions like our regular file descriptors were. So when that directory file descriptor was created for you, we'd specify whether it would allow you to open files in the directory or not. They also had sort of file descriptors that represented like a process, and that would tell you whether you were allowed to kill the process or not. And a key idea of using this capability system is that we wouldn't have any global names. So the only things, if you really opted into this approach, is that you would only access things that you already had a token for. So there would be no sort of notion of checking access control lists. The things you were allowed to access were the tokens you were given when you were started. And so if we imagined a whole system that worked this way, what would happen is rather than the login program setting your user ID, the login program sort of would pass you, you know, the base list of tokens, of capabilities. And those would be the things you'd be allowed to access. So this is kind of a different enforcement mechanism. Rather than saying, here are all the objects, we're going to check access control list as you try to use them, we're going to say, when we start you, here are all the things you can access because we're passing in that list to you. And you know that's what you can access because that's the only things you have tokens for. So the question is, if the file descriptors are just a finite number of ints, wouldn't it be easy for a malicious process to guess and check? So your process would only have these file descriptors for things that it was allowed to access. So there'd be file descriptors for each thing, but not all of them would be open in your process. So only the things that were open as file descriptors in your process you'd be able to access. It's the same idea as if, you know, if I'm running a program on my system that like has, you know, direct access to my printer, that doesn't mean another program can write to that file it has open to write to the printer. So these file descriptors are still per process, you know, separate list of file descriptors per process. And if your process didn't have a file descriptor open for a directory and you didn't have, or you know, some parent directory that you could open that with, sorry, you can't access it. Does that clarify things? Or other questions about this idea? So in sort of the ideal version of this system, you know, we wouldn't have any global names. And sort of the way you'd like access a file is like your program would get a directory file descriptor for the directories you were allowed to access. So let's say you get a file descriptor for your home directory or your shared group directory from the login program, or maybe you know, some server to help you get that. And rather than making an open system call, you make, say, this open at system call, where you specify, in this directory, open this file. And if you wanted to open something outside that directory, sorry. You know, you unless you have a FD file descriptor for that directory, you know, you want to access open, you know, you can't do it. If you wanted to run an executable, you'd have to get a descriptor for the file, and you would open it rather than specifying the name of the program you want to run. And if you wanted to kill a process, rather than, you know, getting its process ID and killing it, you'd have a file descriptor that represented the process, and they added sort of a version of fork that rather than returning a new process ID, will return this file descriptor that let you wait for or kill the process. But the process ID wouldn't work in this system. Like there, that, you know, if you wouldn't use the process ID to identify a process, you use one of these file descriptors. If you didn't have it, well, sorry, you can't do things to that process. Okay, so that's briefly on capability. So we don't see capabilities used much in sort of our usual consumer OSs, but a lot of sort of OSs which haven't felt beholden to sort of the Windows or Linux design have started to embrace this, especially in kind of like the embedded domain. Okay, so for our last 15 minutes, I'm going to talk very briefly about virtual machines. So at the very question is, can I give a specific example of an OS that uses capabilities? Sure. An example is SCL4, I believe, is capability-based. And that's targeting very much the embedded domain. It has a very different system call API as a result. Okay. So at the beginning of the semester, we talked about this idea of a virtual machine interface. And we mentioned that we were talking about this idea, you know, in the class, we mostly talked about this process virtual machine, where the interface we provided, the sort of fake machine that programs are running in, it looks very unlike real hardware. You know, we have these system calls which don't really correspond to anything in the hardware. We have this notion of virtual memory, which, you know, where we can like map files, that doesn't correspond to how like real memory works. And this was in contrast to what we commonly call virtual machines, a sort of like a consumer product, which typically try to imitate the physical interface. I'm going to talk briefly about how do we actually do that. So first, some terminology things. So if we're talking about this system virtual machine idea, well, if we're imitating a physical interface, we're probably going to be running, you know, another OS on our virtual machine here. So we're going to have two OSs. We're going to have a host OS, which is running the other OS, and a guest OS, which is running within, and the program or part of the host OS that enables this is going to be called the hypervisor or the virtual machine monitor. So this is the program or OS component that lets a host OS run another guest OS. So in the case of like VirtualBox, this would be VirtualBox. And if I'm running VirtualBox on Windows, Windows would be my host OS. If I'm running Linux inside VirtualBox, Linux would be my guest OS. Questions about these terms? So the question, is there a difference between an emulator and a system virtual machine? So typically when we talk about emulators instead of these virtual machine monitors or hypervisors, the emulator doesn't directly run the instructions that are in the guest OS. So for example, QEMU typically doesn't actually run the machine code directly that's in your XV6. It translates it instead to other code to run it. Or it does something where it like has like a big switch statement where it looks at the instruction and figures out what to do. One of those, some combination of those things. And therefore we call QEMU more of an emulator in that mode. But it is a kind of fuzzy line. Other questions? Okay. So when we're talking about a virtual machine monitor, generally we're going to, you know, try to run the guest OS code on the real machine, but have it, you know, when it tries to access the hardware, have, you know, us emulate what the real hardware would do. We're going to give it an interface that looks like the real hardware. And there's actually some variation in exactly how close it is. So, like, you get from this picture that, you know, these are all going to imitate real hardware. But commonly, something that will be marketed as one of these sort of system virtual machines will do something a little different. So there's what I'll call full virtualization, where we don't modify the guest OS at all. But often, systems implement paravirtualization, where we make some small modifications to the guest OS to make the virtual machine monitor easy to write. A big example is with page table entries. So you can implement page tables with this full virtualization approach, but it's actually pretty complicated. In fact, we're definitely not going to have time to talk about it today. Not in any detail, at least. So you might change how this works to make it simpler, but that, even though that involves editing the guest OS. But even in paravirtualization, applications that run in the guest OS should still be unmodified. And this is a fuzzy line. So for example, if you have a custom device driver, like, you know, let's say my display driver is for this display driver, which doesn't exist physically, is that paravirtualization or is it just a custom device driver? And full virtualization depends who you ask. So I'm going to talk about one way of implementing virtual machines. There are other ways of doing it. So I'm not going to talk, for example, about the variation that QEMU does where it compiles the guest OS machine code to new machine code. I'm not going to talk about solutions that have extra hardware support. So I'm going to talk about the straightforward way where we're not going to have the hardware helping us very much, and we're going to run the guest OS machine code on the real processor. We're not going to like translate it to something else first. And to think about this, we need to think about sort of what the layering we have is. We're going to have some application in the guest OS, so like our shell in VirtualBox, our guest OS, like if we're running the VirtualBox image I gave you for this course, Linux in VirtualBox, the hypervisor itself, VirtualBox. And I'm going to kind of group the hypervisor, you know, slash host OS together. And in practice, some part of the hypervisor is going to have to be pretty integrated with the host OS, which is why I'm going to kind of group them together and act as if the hypervisor is like part of the host OS, even though that might not be quite true in for all hypervisors. And if we think about how, you know, this hypervisor works, we can kind of think of the hypervisor like a specialized OS. And it's running this guest OS as kind of a process. And in this design, we're going to run all of this stuff in user mode on the hardware. Now, the guest OS, well, the kernel part of the guest OS, it wants to run in kernel mode. And we're going to pretend that we're running it in kernel mode. So in this layering, we're going to have the guest OS running in what I'll call pretend kernel mode, but it's really user mode. And we're going to have the guest OS's programs running in pretend user mode, which is really user mode, but it's, you know, but we have this kind of distinction. And we're going to run the hypervisor slash host OS code in the real kernel mode on the hardware. And what the hypervisor is going to do is going to implement this kind of pretend kernel mode service. So it's going to track all the things that the hardware would normally track for an OS on behalf of this kernel mode code in the guest OS. So the hypervisor, you know, is going to need to track things that we've seen just for normal processes like registers, page tables, when I/O devices are open. So this is just not different than a normal process. Maybe like the way we name I/O devices is different. Like we don't have files. We have like, you know, I/O addresses. But this is the same as a normal process. But we're also going to need to track stuff to implement this pretend kernel mode idea. So for example, the guest OS has a page table pointer. Well, we're not going to implement, you know, that with the hardware page table pointer. So we're going to have to track what the guest OS thinks its page table pointer is so we can pretend it's running in kernel mode. Because in kernel mode, it would have its own page table pointer. So we're going to pretend it does. We're going to track that information. Also, it thinks it has its own exception table pointer. We're going to track that information. So this is extra state we're going to track that stuff the processor would implement for kernel mode because we're emulating the kernel mode interface. And these are going to be sort of extra stuff to translate, you know, our pretend kernel mode that the OS is using into stuff that the real CPU can use. And we'll also have to have some page table. We probably won't talk about how that works today, but we're going to have to do something special for the page table. So in this design, we're running the guest OS, you know, like a normal process, but we're tracking the information that normally the hardware would track for the guest OS's kernel, like whether interrupts work, you know, and whether it's running in kernel mode or not, and so on. So let's look at sort of how we're going to handle, you know, operations that happen in the guest OS. And the big idea that we're going to use to implement this system virtual machine idea is that the guest OS is going to do stuff that triggers an exception when it tries to use functionality that's limited to kernel mode or functionality that should use kernel mode. So for example, if the guest OS has a device driver that tries to talk to a device, that's not going to work because it's in pretend kernel mode. It's not in real kernel mode. You know. So it's going to trigger a page or a protection fault. If the guest OS, say, tries to do some operation like disabling interrupts, it's in pretend kernel mode. It's not going to work. So it's going to trigger a protection fault. If the guest OS makes a system call, that's going to trigger a system call exception, like a normal system call. But for all of these cases, what we're going to do is we're going to handle these exceptions, but we're not going to handle them in the way we did for a normal application. We're going to handle them by trying to imitate what the processor would do. So for example, if the program tries to talk to a device, we're going to imitate talking to the device when that page or protection fault happens. When the page fault happens, we're going to say, okay, what were you trying to do? You were trying to like read from the keyboard. I'm going to emulate that reading from the keyboard operation. When you were trying to disable interrupts, I'm going to emulate that by remembering you disabled interrupts and using that to make sure that in the future I, you know, execute you in a way where it looks like you did that. If you try to make a system call, I'm not going to make a normal system call. I'm going to run your system call handler because that's what the hardware would have done if you were running in real kernel mode. So questions about this idea of responding to the exceptions like what the hardware would do if the guest OS were running natively. The question is, why does it need faults if it's already running in kernel mode? So the guest OS is not running in kernel mode. It thinks it's running in kernel mode, but it's not. Does that answer the question? Yes, we're telling the guest OS it's in kernel mode, but we're lying. And since we're lying, all these things the guest OS might try to do, some of these things the guest OS might try to do that would normally not trigger an exception will. So sort of as an example of what this might look like is the guest OS, say it's trying to access like a device like the keyboard that triggers a protection fault. The hypervisor's protection fault handler will talk to the device and then update the guest OS state and then switch back as if that access worked. So sort of the code we might imagine for that is our trap handler is going to say, oh, you had a trap here. Was this trying to read from the keyboard? If so, let's turn that into a read system call on the host OS. Even though you think you're talking directly to the keyboard, we're going to actually translate that to a read call in the host OS. Then when the read call finishes, we're going to update things as if, you know, the actual sort of read from the keyboard operation happened. So, you know, for example, in XV6, we mentioned that getting the keyboard input was done with this instruction here, where it's reading from a register, a control register for the keyboard, getting this value into the AL register. So our emulation of that would be that we'd say, okay, in our trap handler, if it's a protection fault and the guest OS is in, we should say this is pretend kernel mode, in that case, we're going to see, is it that in instruction? Because that's how, you know, this in instruction here. And if so, we're going to figure out where is it trying to read from. And we're going to say, okay, it's reading from the keyboard input. And I'm going to have this handler for reading from the keyboard input where I'm going to update the destination register of the instruction and also advance the program counter. So when we go back to the guest OS, it's going to continue executing here. So I'm basically emulating this instruction. I'm doing, you know, detailed, you know, step-by-step what the hardware would do for the instruction, except I'm doing something a little bit different in that, you know, I'm not reading directly from the real keyboard. I'm doing, you know, a system call, maybe reading from a terminal instead of like a physical keyboard. And I'm doing this by kind of parsing what the instruction the guest OS was trying to run should have done. And this pattern of when this exception happens, look at the instruction that the guest OS was trying to run and figure out what it should have done. This is sort of the key idea for doing sort of this very simple, conceptually simple, I should say, virtual machine implementation. It's conceptually simple because obviously this code gets really complicated, you know, and, you know, I'm even skipping over things which are obviously really annoying, like we have to have like an instruction parser in here, and parsing x86 instructions is not fun, but it's something that people have done to implement this kind of virtual machine. So questions about sort of this example of trap and emulate? So we call it trap and emulate because trap happens, an exception, and we emulate what the instruction should have done. Question is, so the trap handler knows these exceptions are from the guest OS? Yeah, so we need to do some bookkeeping to know that this exception happened when the guest OS thought it was running in its kernel, in its pretend kernel mode. Other questions about this? So is this trap in the hypervisor or the actual OS? So this is the hypervisor and or the host OS. So the hypervisor typically needs to be very integrated with the host OS because it needs to get this sort of information. Other questions? Okay. So I guess one other thing about sort of what this trap and emulation approach means is that when we have something like a system call How do we emulate that? Well, what the real hardware would do is it run the guest OS's system call handler. So we were going to, in our hypervisor, reflect that back to the guest OS running its system call handler. So this is another sort of part of the process of doing this trap and emulate approach, is that, you know, system calls in the program, they don't turn into system calls in our host OS, they turn into system calls in our guest OS. So we have to have logic to figure out, oh, that's a system call in this virtual machine, make it a system call that runs the guest OS. And also when the guest OS returns from a system call, we need to remember to return back to the program because the hardware would do that on our system call return normally. This is where I'm gonna leave off today. This is all we're gonna talk about for virtual machines. I'll take other questions before I sign off though. So a question from someone who's been in my security class where we talked about containers. Why would we use a VM over a container? So a VM, because we're running a separate OS, you know, we have more isolation. We don't need to share a kernel, you know, with the main OS. So, and practically speaking, the biggest advantage is they're like, you know, I can't use containers to run Windows on Linux, but I can use virtual machines to do that.